One of the social phenomena I've become most fascinated by is something I'll call false validity. It's when we as a society perpetuate a behavior or idea as being totally valid and acceptable, when it is in fact absolutely invalid by any reasonable or moral standard. And we know it's invalid, but for whatever reason, we all agree to ignore this reality and allow the unacceptable behavior to continue. It's like we've all been hypnotized to cluck like chickens, except we haven't been, but we're clucking anyway, and we could just, you know, stop. As it pertains to the Jewish world, I see this phenomenon most manifest as the false and harmful belief that it is somehow moral or mandatory or admirable even to conflate a person's Jewish identity with one's own negative feelings about Israel's role in the Middle East. Put another way, it's the idea held by millions of people out there that simply being a Jew is somehow controversial or political. Well, needless to say, that's bullshit. It's not true, it's contrived, it's wrong, and we cannot tolerate it anymore. You can debate an idea, but you can't debate a person's existence. Do you know what you call someone who makes aggressively negative assumptions about an individual based purely on morally bankrupt misunderstandings of their group? A bigot. A racist. Now, I've heard the counter to my assertion of bigotry many times on social media, and it too is a sham. Something like, it's not racist to not support the genocide of children. Okay, first of all, no decent human being supports acts of genocide or the killing of children. We know this. To pretend otherwise is to be knowingly disingenuous because the real goal is just to spread this 21st century blood libel and demonize Jews. I say 21st century because Jews have been dealing with this a long time. The original blood libel was the grotesque accusation during the Middle Ages that Jews were murdering Christian children in order to use their blood to bake Passover matzah. This horrific lie was widely believed and used for centuries as an excuse to persecute the demonic Jews. Sound familiar? It should. Because like all other elements of anti-Jew hate, blood libel continues to morph over time into whatever disgusting accusation will most rally the masses against the Jewish minority. That's right. We're demonized so often and so consistently, we have our own term for it. Back to bigotry. Drawing a link of causational responsibility between any random Jewish person and whatever has or hasn't happened in Israel is racist. Does anyone blame random Chinese Americans for the very real Chinese imprisonment and torture and sterilization of over a million Uyghur Muslims? Of course not. That would be racist. And most people don't even know who Uyghur Muslims are because this whole posture is just about hating Jews, not about a sincere, globally applied principle. Also, simply displaying some part of one's Jewish identity is in no way an indicator of one's feelings about the Middle East. Lighting Shabbat candles has nothing to do with the war in Gaza. Wearing a Magen David has nothing to do with the war in Gaza. A bagel shop in Brooklyn has nothing to do with the war in Gaza. A social media clip about Jews and tattoos has nothing to do with the war in Gaza. We know this. And yet those who harass Jews in the name of being anti-Zionist continue to get off scot-free. So why is this obviously hollow and terrible behavior allowed to thrive? Why is it so pervasive that many, if not most, Jews believe that to openly identify with their own natural self is somehow sensitive or political or making a statement? Why are we clucking like chickens when we could just not? We could just not do that. We could make a choice, and in an instant, we could be not clucking. I'll tell you why. Because we allow it. We take the path of least resistance. We allow the anti-Jew bigots to dictate the rules of the game when we should be rejecting the entire premise of the game itself. But we're too afraid. Most Jews I talk to don't even really know specifically what it is they're afraid of, just that they are. It's some vague fear of maybe losing social media acceptance or career opportunities or maybe physical violence. I know standing tall as a Jewish person today can seem hard or scary, but we can't allow ourselves to succumb to fear. Can you think of any major Jewish figures whose lives have been ruined because they identified publicly as Jewish? Is Jerry Seinfeld suddenly not selling out every theater he walks into? Is Scooter Braun suddenly not worth billions of dollars? Is Amy Schumer not starring in her own TV series? Sure, Jerry gets heckled, like he hasn't been handling hecklers for 40 years. Sure, they get smoke on social media. We all do. But who cares? It has no bearing on real life. I understand there is a psychological toll. I have experienced it. But what do you think is actually more damaging? The fleeting comments of random, hateful internet strangers? Or being so afraid of random, hateful internet strangers that you're repressing part of your own identity and going through life as less than your full, authentic self? And as far as career and relationships go, yes, you might lose some friends or some jobs. But if those people are going to turn on you because you're a Jew, these are not the friends or the jobs you want. You deserve better than to work for someone who doesn't respect your humanity. You deserve better friends than a bigot who puts their own misguided beliefs about a recent geopolitical conflict they are not in any way involved with over your own personal relationship. Believe me, by shedding these people from your lives, even if it's painful now, you're doing yourself a favor. Trim the fat, baby. Call the haters. And in the words of Madame Horrible from Wicked, the movie of which comes out this weekend, by the way, it's going to blow your frickin' minds. As one door closes, another one opens. To a person, everyone who has come out of the closet as a Jew ends up with new job opportunities they wouldn't have imagined, new friends and supporters and allies they'd never have met. And man, I'm telling you this from experience. Pairing all that positivity and goodness and solidarity with a complete sense of self is a total level up in every way possible. And as for fear of violence, we all fall prey to what's called the availability heuristic, which is when we judge the likelihood of an event based on how easily we're able to recall recent examples of it, with no thought given to actual statistics or data. How many people, public figures or everyday folks, have been physically attacked around the world for being Jewish since October 7th? I don't know the answer, but it's not a lot. Let's generously say it's 1,000 people. That's 0.00001% of the Jewish population. And I don't say this to minimize the absolute horror of these attacks or the very real fear they inspire. But your odds of being in that 0.00001% are obviously quite low. When in doubt, let the immutability of math put you at ease. So the whole experience of coming out as Jewish is really kind of like walking through the wall at platform 9 3/4 to get to the Hogwarts Express. You think you're looking at a painful smash into a brick wall, but the rest of your life is waiting for you on the other side, and it's more than you could have ever dreamed of. And this goes for any identity. Being who you are and feeling connected to that, or proud of it, or loving it, is not political. Do not allow anyone to pretend that it is. If someone has a problem with you loving yourself, that is their problem, not yours. When I snap my fingers, you will all stop clucking. This is the 10th episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. Though she hails from Hackney and lives in Brooklyn, I first met today's guest in Israel when we both participated in an influencer lab under the amazing Tel Aviv Institute. I would wear sunglasses indoors to mask my inability to stay awake during the long presentations, while she responded enthusiastically to every single prompt and would basically not stop talking. Well, today, boy, am I glad she hasn't stopped talking. She is a museum and gallery represented artist whose unique multidisciplinary practice incorporates sculpture, textile, ceramics, photography, and large-scale public installations. She is a hardcore feminist, a hardcore mama, a hardcore Hebrew, advocating tirelessly for the Jewish people online, in her art, and throughout the art world. I'm so happy to be sitting down with her today. Please welcome my friend, Zoe Buckman.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for being here. I really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me. I love your intro.
Oh, thank you. So you're from Hackney, East London. Unfamiliar terrain to probably a lot of the people who are listening to this show. What's the vibe in Hackney and what was the Jewish community like there when you were living there?
Okay, yeah, there was no Jewish community.
Okay.
Growing up, it was really, really rough. There was famously a street that was called Murder Mile was in Hackney.
Pleasant.
I know, so I'm so proud. I grew up there. Our house growing up was broken into and robbed six, seven times. Yeah.
That's
terrifying. I know. So you get the picture, super rough.
Why didn't you move?
Was it?
I mean, there are other places,
My parents couldn't really afford to move anywhere better. It would just be like uprooting us and exchanging it for just another set of problems. And, you know, they liked the schools that we went to. It was also kind of amazing, you know, and it taught me a lot. It taught me things that you can't learn in schools and university and
got
whatnot.
Some street smarts.
Exactly. Yeah. It was a Turkish and Kurdish neighborhood, so very, very Muslim, but also loads of West African, Bangladeshi, Pakistani, and very, very Caribbean as well.
Was there anywhere you could go outside your house where you could feel Jewish, or was it really just inside?
No, it was very much a private thing, and I don't think I actually realized how there was that kind of incongruence with my Jewish identity and who I was outside of the home until I was older. So basically my Jewish identity was something that, although existed always, it was really like galvanized at the weekend because my mom would take us to our grandparents' house. And there it was all the great aunties and all the great uncles, the Jewish jokes, the slang, crazy food. And so a very Jewish Saturday. And then we would come back into the week and there wasn't that kind of, outside of the home, there wasn't that reminder. And you know what's so different about growing up in London to now living in New York, where I've lived for 17 years, is that, you know, the UK is, England's a Christian state.
Right.
And I didn't even really realize what a big impact that has. You don't have Yom Kippur off, you don't have Rosh Hashanah off. So those words aren't even in the public vernacular.
Right.
I didn't actually know what these holidays were until I come to America and I see it's on the calendar and everyone goes home. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. That's so interesting. There's a lot of anti-Jewish sentiment on display these days in the UK.
Yeah.
Did you feel that when you were there, or does that feel like a new phenomenon?
I did feel it growing up. I felt it in that, like, you know, there were not Jewish jokes like our Jewish jokes.
Jews are the butt of the joke.
Exactly. I didn't realize actually that my brother told me recently that he was beaten up on the way to school like every morning because he was the Jewish kid.
My God.
I grew up in operating and immersed in left-wing spaces.
Yeah.
Like we all do, I felt it from both sides where there would be like little microaggressions. I worked as a cocktail waitress for like 5 years in London. And so I was serving very wealthy, sort of aristocratic white English people. And so would hear and, you know, be adjacent to some anti-Semitism from that crowd. But where I would really experience it.
That you would like overhear or directed towards you?
No, that I would overhear. Yeah. You know, like, oh yeah, this club's run by a Jew. It was funny, isn't it? Typical Jew at the end of the night counting up his money.
Right.
And you're like, that's all club owners counting up their money at the end. That's when you do that.
Right, right.
Do you know what I mean? Stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I really started to feel it, you know, as a teenager and becoming a young woman in London. I would really see it in the left big time.
What a shame.
I know.
What are your friends and family back home saying now about what's going on there?
Friends is really, really good. You know, do I have friends in London anymore? No, I do have friends in London. A lot of my best friends have cut me out of their life post October 7th. So that's been a whole like kind of big, almost like paradigm shifting event when all of us, everyone who has any skin in the game is connected in any way to this horrible, horrible conflict and war. For all of us, it's just been really, really difficult. And that's been like an added layer on top of that. It makes you love your true ride or dies even more. I get a lot of messages from Jews in London who feel very at sea right now and unsafe. Like some of us feel physically unsafe, and some just feel like I can't in the workplace just be myself and talk about things freely.
Psychological safety.
And then what does that do in the long term if, you know, you're speaking in coded language, which I don't know if you do this, but I've like literally I'll just be like I'll say something like, let's say I'm in an Uber and I'm on my own and I'm on the phone, and I'll be like, oh yeah, so are you going to that, you know, that thing that we do on the Friday night? And someone will be like, Shabbat. And I'm like, yeah, that one. Or I'll be like, oh, you know, so-and-so is visiting from the motherland.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
You don't feel comfortable letting people know that like you're Jewish or that you're connected to Judaism or the motherland in any way.
Like, so you feel that way in New York that you can't say that out loud.
Yeah. And a lot of that is also to do with like being in a woman's body and just being like, all right, I'm on the train. Like, listen, I'm Morgan David it up, baby. I got my highs and all of these things.
Looking good. Love it.
Thanks,
love the bling.
Ditto.
Thank you.
Having said that, I'm not an idiot. So like, often when I'm on the subway and I'm on my own, which getting on the subway, you have to like almost like get right with God anyway, just to
it's already a dicey enterprise.
You know, I tuck things in often when I'm on the train on my own. In London, I think that there is even less of a robust Jewish community. And so, I feel really, really awful for my Londoners right now. It's hard.
Yeah. I want to go back to something you mentioned. You said best friends have cut you out.
Yes.
People that you like truly felt were your best friends?
Like sisters. Like I'm the godmother one of their babies.
To what do you attribute like a political, what to them is sort of a political thing happening, a geopolitics thing coming before a sister? Like how does that happen?
It's beyond. I think the only way to make sense of it is to understand that there is a deep, deep anti-Semitism like ingrained in people. In the case, I'm thinking of this one bestie who made me the godmother of her child. So I know that she loved me at one point enough to be like,
clearly, that's
I want you in my kid's life forever.
Yeah.
Absolutely a sister of mine. And then the week of October 7th, at some point she unfollowed me on Instagram and I never heard from her ever again, right? And it's like, I feel that my exhibiting any Jewish pain in that moment, any Jewish pride ever, like I feel like it suddenly became so like unpalatable that she was like, I can't.
Had the Jewish part of you been in conversation with her before October 7th?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what's so interesting, because I'm like, there should be no surprise that I am upset that this thing happened.
She already knows that's a big part of your identity.
Right, exactly. And I've always said from day one and October 7th, like my prayer is for peace and sovereignty and safety for the people of Palestine and for the people of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But was I angry and upset? Yes. Sure. Like I know a lot of people who that day lost their loved ones. I know people who are still missing loved ones and praying for their return. So like this does affect me.
Yeah.
And you know, the huge instant spike in anti-Semitism affects me. And so, you know, it's almost like counterintuitive to what being friends are. And it's very, I think, emblematic of where we are at right now. Like ultimately, we can disagree in friendships about anything, and politics will do that, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, exactly. If I see a sister of mine and she is in pain and she doesn't feel safe, like there is literally nothing that would make me run away from her. Like I will run towards her, even if I'm like, babe, I don't agree with what you're saying right now, and we can get into that later. Are you okay?
Yeah, I mean, that to me is natural.
Right, and so seeing that happened with three of my friends in London,
wow,
in unison, I guess, then I'm like, well, we have a massive, massive problem of anti-Semitism in the UK and in the left, in that it's become so tribal and so cult-like that it would make three like rational, beautiful women who are like good women in in all other ways, like act so incredibly anti-Semitically.
Very reminiscent of, you know, 1930s Germany.
Yeah. What I've really come to realize is that the rise of the Nazis, it was like this kind of like drip drip effect of anti-Semitism. And it started with pushing Jews to the margins and boycotting them and like a bit of broken glass here, a bit of vandalism there. Oops, this person's been fired. Oh, this person's an untouchable now socially and a pariah. Mm-hmm. And then that drip drip effect, if allowed to grow, will end in violence, will then develop into violence.
Yep.
Hitler didn't make everyone in Germany anti-Semitic. He just allowed them to be, like they already were.
Right.
So that's what I'm realizing about these former friends of mine. It's not that they suddenly woke up and were like, ugh.
It's just socially acceptable now.
It was there. It was always there.
In America, it started on the right with the rise of Donald Trump, sort of normalizing basically whoever you hate, you're allowed to hate them out loud now on that side. And then in the past couple of years, we're seeing now on the left via this, you know, fake progressiveness that you're allowed to hate on Jews from the left too. And that's totally okay as long as you call them Zios instead of Jews.
Yeah, man, it's fucking crazy.
So I wanna transition now away from terrible anti-Semitism things.
Should we talk about some jolly things?
No, this is not jolly
it's
either.
Not jolly.
Well, it's half jolly.
Okay.
I want to talk about your mom.
Okay.
So there is some jolly, but there's also some sadness.
Yes.
Do you call her mum?
Yeah, mum.
Okay,
yeah,
mum.
Exactly.
So let's talk about your mum. So she died in 2019 after 9 years with cancer.
Yes.
You have spoken about her a lot and expressed your feelings for her a lot through your art.
Mm.
Now, well, both your parents are Jewish. You once said in an interview, your Jewish identity you get from your mother.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
So what I mean by that is that, you know, my dad, he grew up atheist, agnostic, and there's Jewish roots there. Mm-hmm. Like the family name was Salomon, but that comes from Solomon. And so at one point that was changed and we really don't know the context of that. But my mom was Jewish with a capital J and really like instilled in us, we are Jews. Like we might not, you know, practice, and my children, like, you guys aren't gonna know the prayers, don't ask me about that, I can't be bothered, I'm busy, kind of thing. But the Jewish identity and culture, that was like very like rooted in who she was.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Did you have any source of like Jewish education, or was just whatever came from your family?
No, absolutely zero. I mean, it was literally Jewish jokes, babe.
Right.
Like that was it. And like a Jewish sensibility, a generosity, a kind of extending out to people in the community,
So like a value.
You need to
vibe.
Eat. Yeah. You must eat. Let me feed you. Let me roll you a spliff. I'm going to get you a cab home. Do you know what I mean? Like all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And an awareness of our otherness, an awareness of the history of suffering, but an awareness of our resilience and choosing joy and choosing humor and the questioning, debating.
Yeah.
Oh my God, the debating in my family was like pretty extra at times. But I feel like, because I've watched your podcast, obviously, and I've listened to all of these amazing conversations. So grateful that you're doing this.
Oh, thank you.
And I remember you saying something which I agree with and I don't agree with.
Oh, great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You said, you know, everyone who comes on this show, or most people who come on this show, say, I'm Jewish, but.
Mm-hmm.
And what I thought of when you explained that is like, first of all, you're absolutely right. Who's the arbiter of how Jewish one is or isn't? Mm-hmm. Like, fuck that, right?
Yeah, totally.
And I thought about this Leonard Cohen quote where he's like, yeah, I'm Jewish. And in the way, you can't be a little bit pregnant. You can't be a little bit Jewish.
I love that.
I love that. I love that. And
totally.
I really agree with it. But that's not my experience at all.
Okay.
Because my experience, first of all, to use his analogy of being pregnant, is that there's this daily growing reminder in your tummy, in your breast, in your mood, in your ability to formulate thought. You are very, very aware every day that you are pregnant. And for me, with my Jewish upbringing and the lack of Jewish community, it has been an active choice for me. And in a way, I find that quite exciting and hopeful, because I know that like for people like me, like they can choose to step into it more than they have been. And it can be this kind of like, it can be an action.
I actually don't think that's disagreeing with me at all.
Damn,
actually.
I wanted to fight. I wanted to bait.
I know, me too. But I agree with you. And I think the line I like to say is, you're as Jewish as you feel.
Mm.
And I think that is, I mean, what you're saying in the sense that if you want to be more connected, you should be and you can be, and you need to take steps in order to do that. But what I just don't want anyone to feel like, oh, I'm not Jewish because I don't know this holiday. I'm not Jewish enough because I don't do what you do.
Yeah, agreed. And that's exciting because there's something that we can all do. I think something I personally feel quite a lot of fear about is that if I look back at my family, all of my aunties and uncles married non-Jews, which is a beautiful, beautiful thing. And we have like a very, very diverse family. We're like a school. It's beautiful. Every single one of my cousins and my siblings also did not marry Jews. Mm-hmm. And so what I want to do... What I want to do is I want to get bat mitzvah with myself, me.
Amazing, because you never have. You should.
I'm
trying to get my wife to do it. Weekly shout out to Courtney.
Yes, yes, Courtney. Maybe me and her will do it together.
I think it's so cool. You should totally do that. It'll be so meaningful and amazing. And like anything in life, like you'll appreciate it more as a grown-up than you would at 13.
So, yeah, so true, you know? So true. But I kind of want to do it for my nieces and nephews. Like I want to save up and then fly them out. And I want them to see that like, even, you know, as a 39 years young woman, like you guys can do this. You can step into this at any point.
What about your own kid? Is there going to be a B'nai Mitzvah in the future?
No, my kid doesn't want to. My kid's 13 and, you know, me and their dad have like, we haven't really instilled the religious aspect enough. But I think this will also be a kind of like, yeah, but mum's doing this. So just know.
You could do it together.
That you can, exactly.
That could be special.
And how special would that
be? That would be amazing. That would be very unique.
I know. Listen, I'm trying the Jewish guilt. I'm definitely doing it. Like, oh, you're going to make me do it alone.
Getting back to mum.
Yes.
You wrote a beautiful article about her for British Vogue.
Oh, yeah.
It's beautiful. A year after her passing.
Yeah.
We'll put it in the show notes so you all can check it out. This is actually going to be a really good show notes episode. There's going to be a lot of Zoe Buckman things to check out. You had a line in it that really struck me. You said that when your mother and best friend dies, you have to die too and then rebirth yourself. Mm-hmm. Very simple but poignant way of framing that process of carrying on, I think, because you're not just saying goodbye to the person you lost, you're saying goodbye to life as you knew it forever.
Yeah.
How is your rebirth going 5 years out?
It still sucks so much. Mm. It's still like hands down the worst thing that has happened to me, the worst thing I've experienced. And actually,
what's worse
like,
than that?
Nothing. Yeah. For me, nothing. And that's actually quite a long list of shitty things.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, trauma, any trauma, but especially a grief like that, like it really does take something out of you, and you do die. This whole side of you dies.
Yeah.
And then you realize that like it will never be filled, first of all. Like that is there now and that is part of you, and it's about kind of like living around that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like you try to put things back together, but you have to put things back together around this gaping hole that's missing.
Yeah.
And you do. And you know, and no one can tell. You from the outside you look normal, but inside it's always gonna be there, I think. And that's unfortunately how I feel about grief. And I wish I had, you know, more optimistic things to say about it. Some people are like, oh yeah, you know, it's really just how much you grieve a loss is about how strong that love was.
Right.
And that's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so shitty.
Yeah, it still sucks. It sucks. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Also in this article, there was, you know, I detected a bit of bitterness from you about the way people around you were treating you in your grief.
Yeah.
Not really giving you what it felt like you needed. At least that was my takeaway. Has that changed at all?
I think I've learned a lot since then. And then of course we had a pandemic and then we had October 7th. And I've learned to do a lot of radical acceptance in that like, okay, I see you and I see who you are. And that's not me. That's not how I show up for people. But I accept you, and then it's my choice. It's my choice of like, do I still want to fucks with you, or do I not want to fucks with you? British people avoid and don't want to talk about pain, right? They're like,
right.
Move on, carry on, beer.
Yeah.
And American people would be like, oh my God, so like when you next see a butterfly, that's your mom. Right. Have you seen any butterflies this week? Because that's your mom. And I'm like, that's not my fucking mom.
I love your American accent, by the way. That is really fun.
Okay. They're like, that plant in your room. Right. Like, she's in that plant. I'm right. like, that's so creepy. Don't say these things to me.
I can relate to the piece of having to adjust expectations for people.
Yeah.
Because I'm a very active friend.
Yeah.
And like, so I'm the one who's making the plans. I'm the one who's calling on the birthday, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And it took me, you know, like 37 years to be like, it's okay if other people don't do what I'm doing. I can yes. still be friends with them and not feel horribly betrayed every yes. time they don't do the exact thing that I would be doing.
It's a constant practice.
Keep working the muscle.
Yeah, man.
So you and your and your mother have complimentary tattoos.
Yes.
So she has F blank 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 D-O-M.
Yes.
And you F-dom. Have the R-E-E.
I have the R-E-E
of freedom. Here. Tell me the story behind that.
So we were in the garden. My mom was a big crossword woman, like totally loved language and things that were naughty and silly and whatnot. And I was like, we knew that she was dying. We knew that, you know, we had a finite amount of time left. And I was like, you know, what do you want to do? And she was like, I'd quite like to get a tattoo. I was like, sick, yes, let's go. What do you think you want to get? And she's like, freedom. And I'm thinking like, this is an old woman still in chemo, like that shit's gonna hurt. I really wasn't sure if like, is that okay? So I was like, mom, you know, that's a great idea. That's a lot of letters though. You know, and she was like, no, yeah, you're right, I could do F-dom. And which of course is like, you know, it's a abbreviation of like female domination and F-dom and, you know, fuckdom is also.
Right.
And then I was like, okay, so what will I get? And she was like, Ree. I was like, mom, this is brilliant. Genius. Yalla, let's go.
That's so nice.
Yeah.
I want to steal that idea
you
in
can.
Some way.
You
I love
absolutely
it.
Can.
Not,
I, would
I don't know
honored.
If it'll be freedom, but I love the idea of sort of interlocking yeah. tattoos like that.
Yeah.
What role, if any, did any kind of Jewish tradition or spirituality play in your mother's final days or through her passing?
My mom, as I've explained, there wasn't really any religion, and she really didn't have like a relationship to the idea of God, and I did. And so that was something that I think was, it's not that there was tension, but we were just very different in that way.
Sure.
But her last Passover, I had never seen her commit to like really, really doing it right. And it was interesting to see because my mom was super irreverent, and like everything, there was an opportunity to find like silliness in it, right? And that's what I expected. That's how I showed up in the spirit of my mother,
right?
Her last Seder, got to my parents' living room, and suddenly she was like, Zebby, you got to take this seriously. And I was like, oh, right, fuck, yeah, shit. Okay, man. Yeah,
we're doing something different here.
All right, let's go. And that was really interesting because I think that evening I got this sense, I was like, maybe there was this awareness of like, I want to get this right because this is my last shot. Like, I want to get right with them upstairs, her upstairs, him upstairs, whomever upstairs. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Has that had any lasting impact on you, do you think?
Yeah, I think about it a lot. I think about it every Passover, but I think about, so I've started to light Shabbat candles on a Friday evening.
Nice.
Pretty much cry every time.
Oh. What is that about?
Well, when I do it, whether I'm doing it alone or whether it's the week that my kid's with me and we do it together, I can't help but think about the women that came before me. Mm. And see, fuck, Jonah.
That's okay.
I think about what it took for them to continue this tradition, what it took for any of us to be Jewish,
yeah,
is that someone really, really had to want to pass this on. It wasn't easy. It was never been easy. Like, it would have been so much easier to put it down and to hide that part of yourself, right? You'd literally be physically safer. But our ancestors didn't. Time and time again, they kept doing it. And so on a weekly basis, to do this very small ritual connects me back, and it's typically done by the women.
Yeah.
It connects me back to the women who I've come from. And I also can't help but think about sadly, the female hostages, is that also comes into mm-hmm. my mind. You know, where are they? Do they know that it's Shabbat? And yeah. you know, and I think about what's going on right now on both sides of the conflict over there. And it just brings me to tears pretty much every week. So jolly in my house.
But no, that's so meaningful, you know, and I love hearing you express that, because people lose sight of that perspective a lot.
Yeah.
That, you know, we didn't get here by accident. We got here by being incredibly defiant for thousands of years and sort of refusing to go quietly into the night.
Yeah, exactly. But to answer your question, I feel like once a week I invoke a little bit of the spirit that my mom approached that last Seder with. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, giving it real weight and significance and taking it seriously for a couple minutes.
Yeah, and binding back to this ancient tradition and this lineage.
I love that. If you do, how do you talk to your child about what's happening now for Jews in Israel? Like, how much are you divulging? What are you trying to instill?
It's been a difficult balance throughout the past year. I think that last year, right after October 7th, I was so fucking distraught and in it, and I was consuming so much media, right?
Yeah.
And I was a little obsessed. And I don't think that was a good example for my kid.
Hard to resist. I think we all were.
Exactly.
I mean, what a moment in history. And you want to know what's going on. You want to feel connected. It was all happening in real time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's understandable.
Yeah. And I also, you know, I feel like one of my approaches to being a parent is that, like, look, I'm human, babe. Like, mm-hmm. I'm human, so I'm messy sometimes. Yeah. I'm distraught sometimes, and like that's hard for you to see that and be around it. But I'd rather you see me in all my shades.
Yeah.
Then I'm like doing that kind of like very English stiff upper lip. Mummy's fine.
Wait till the door's closed.
Exactly, and then I break. You know, right now I'm trying to instill like Jewish pride, and also like a kind of, I guess, the understanding that, like, knowing our history and knowing where we come from and choosing to step into that in our lifetime. And I'm trying to show my kid, you can do this, and like, you should be doing this. And I think we all should in whatever way we can.
In that article, you attribute so many positive aspects of your personality to having gotten them from your mom.
Yeah.
But I would be remiss if we didn't show some love to Pops.
Oh.
You know.
My dad would be pissed if I didn't show some love.
Yeah, so like, tell me a little bit about your dad and what you feel like you've inherited from him.
That's a good question, Jonah. Mm. Why are you doing this to me?
You know, I go for the real stuff.
My dad, the thing that made things difficult, to be completely honest, and he knows this, so hopefully he won't have a problem with me sharing this publicly, but my dad grieved really, really, really hard for 3 months and then was like, yeah, no, fuck that. And got a girlfriend who he married very quickly. Mm. And that came with what we, his children, felt like was this kind of like real, like almost that chapter of my life that involved your mother, that's done. Come and get your things that you want of hers. You know, I've moved on now, kind of thing. And we were like, I'm still wearing black, bruv. Like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Like, I'm barely starting to eat again, and I'm supposed to accept this new, like, I wish that he had kind of kept his new enthusiastic feelings of love towards a new person. I kind of wish that he had kept that a little bit quiet.
Yeah.
That was really hard for us.
This is not the first example of this that I have heard about or seen up close. You were saying earlier when you were talking about grief, I actually thought about it then. You're like, there's this hole that you can't refill.
Yeah.
When it's your spouse, you sort of can replace it in a way.
Right. But if that's so interesting.
But if it's not your spouse, it's irreplaceable. Like, you can't replace your mom. You can't replace a sibling. You can't replace your best friend.
Yeah.
But you can remarry. You can have love again. So I think it's a different kind of grief that I don't think we like think about enough as we're going through these things, that if I'm the person who's remarrying, the other people around me can't re-get a mom.
That's exactly
it, babe. And as much as those people deserve to move on and build a new chapter and whatever, it's very painful for the other people who can't move on in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, obviously we want my dad to be happy. We absolutely do. And he is, which is fantastic. And she's great. And good. That's cool. Thank God. But it was just really, really fucking hard.
Totally. That's very fast. So you are now single. Is that right?
That is right.
You're single, but your ex-husband is a Jew.
Yes.
Has marrying a Jewish man always been important to you? Was that a factor?
I think Jewish men are so sexy.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a deal breaker, mm-hmm. right? And it's still not a deal breaker, but it's like you would have to be a real ally right now for me to want to date someone who wasn't Jewish. Mm-hmm. I think my experience of being married to a Jewish man, and obviously like I'm talking in like absolute generalizations, but I see this with so many Jewish men, is that they're fucking incredible husbands and wonderful fathers, like second to none. And so co-parenting with my ex-husband is kind of a dream.
Great.
Yeah, and thank God, man. Yeah, and
one thing off your plate.
Bruv. And like we really got each other's back. We're very, very aligned spiritually and politically in this moment. So like it's really beautiful to have that support.
Yeah.
But yeah, dating, like he kind of probably does need to be Jewish. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I care a great deal about it myself. Okay, so let's get into your art a little bit.
Okay.
I loved looking at all your art as I was preparing for this. Because, you know, I've looked at it here and there, but I really like did a little bit of a deep dive. From my like macro overview of your work, it was fascinating to see your evolution from sort of broader themes and ideas to much more personal, raw, Zoe stories. It was also interesting to see it sort of mirrored in the materials you used.
Yeah.
Like you started with more synthetic, more impersonal materials, plastic, glass.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, you know, you're moving to boxing gloves with embroidery and lace and flowers. And now you've got these, you know, full on natural textile, colorful, ornate, like 3D things.
Yeah.
It's no surprise to me that the piece of yours that now hangs in the Whitney is from Tended, your 2023 art show you did here in New York. Mm. First of all, mazel tov for having a piece in the Whitney.
You.
It's a huge deal. Tell me about the piece itself and how you found out that they were putting it in the permanent collection.
There's this photo that we've had for years, and my brother took it with a film camera. It's a black and white photo of me and my now sister-in-law, and we're sat on my bed and I'm drawing on her back. She's my absolute bestie. So it's really meaningful to me that a depiction of us is going to live in the permanent collection of the Whitney Museum of American Art. I would never have imagined this when I was 17 and high and drawing on her back and making very, very bad art. Like it was for a photography project that was like so basic 101, what a million, you know, teenagers have made in the past. But anyway, my brother captured what I felt was this like really unique, intimate moment because she's not clothed and we're there and we're, you know, and I'm sort of like I'm facing her back and I'm creating something. And so I used that photo as like the source material, painted it onto this large tablecloth in my studio, and then did a shitload of hand embroidery and a bunch of applique and stained with ink and whatnot. And so the finished piece, I hope, shows not just this intimate moment, but this idea of like all of this like growth and wilderness and potential. Because I think about who we were then as women and who we are today. And I think about our different awakenings at different points and like our kind of expansion as women.
What's the piece called?
Songs Leak From My Bedroom Walls. Imagine if I didn't remember at all. That would be really embarrassing.
You took a second.
Listen.
Well, hey, because your titles are not easy to grab onto.
No.
They're these poetic phrases.
Yeah.
Do you project it when you paint?
I've never tried to make photoreal art, you know? And there's plenty of artists out there who use projection and create these things that you look at them and you're like, that's a photograph. Oh my God, that's not a photograph. What the fuck?
Yeah.
That's never been what I've tried to make. Like, I always want to show our mess, our toil, our imperfections, which is why there's a lot of threads, which is why I use ink. Because when you use ink on fabric, it obviously bleeds out. It's quite hard to manipulate. And so there is always this kind of like, something's a bit wrong there and off. And that's like, that's what I think is interesting about life, actually. And then the embroidery, like people have asked me, you know, like, why don't you just get other people to do that for you? And I'm like, because then it would turn out perfect. And then it wouldn't be about what I'm trying to say.
Is it imperfect because you're an imperfect sower.
Exactly. Okay. That.
It's not like you're like, oh, I need to mess up this line right now.
No, okay. No, it's imperfect because I'm a fucking mess.
Okay.
And it's not like I'm a professional.
So you can't get better at it. You can't do it too much that you improve.
I must not.
I want to bring up one piece from your 2015 show, Present Life, which was all about motherhood and pregnancy, where you actually turned your plasticized placenta into a piece.
Yes.
What was the reaction to that? And what does your kiddo think about it now?
The reaction was, wait, who's put a placenta on the Bowery? I guess we need to go see that. My kid.
That's good. That's a good thing, right? I mean, did it bring a lot of attention?
It was my first show, and it kind of like put me on the map in the New York art world. Mm. And a woman, a really big art collector who's been a wonderful support, asked to buy it because she's smart. And she was like, that's the piece that I want. Mm-hmm. And I had to explain to her, as an artist who had never sold a piece before, this was my first show, I'd never ever sold anything, desperately wanted her approval and to be in her collection. And I had to be like, I'm so sorry, that's not for sale.
You can have the neon one.
Yeah, you have the neon one, exactly. Yeah. The reaction, you know, I think my kid has grown up with crazy artist mom who's like, bringing things into the home and turning it into art and like putting our stories out there. And I'm sure that my kid is going to be incredibly embarrassed at times in their life and hopefully proud at other times too.
One thread through your work, pun intended, is femininity.
Yes.
Which has already come up a lot in this conversation. Whatever you're tackling in your art, it's about women, it's by a woman, it is for women. Mm-hmm. This past year, as you've alluded to, we've seen horrible violence, kidnapping, sexual violence towards Israeli women. We've seen terrible oppression of women in Iran. Has any of that trauma made its way into your art over the past year?
We saw the testimonies from the people who handled the bodies. We saw the testimonies from the survivor. We all know, everyone knows or should know what happened. And the denial that is still out there after a year, that has affected me in a way that like I will never get over that, actually. Yeah. Like seeing what is pretty much the most widely documented cases of rape I've ever known about, in that the atrocities were filmed
by those committing them.
Hello. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. Why are we debating this? And then seeing how there were so many voices online and in the left and in communities that I used to be a part of actually denying it and saying this is a lie, this is made up. Mm. In the context of Holocaust denial, where you've also got like, what is it, 30% or more than 30% of New Yorkers who deny the Holocaust or think that we're over exaggerating and whatnot. Then we know there's a phenomenon going on, which is that the trauma that the Jewish people survive or experience is made up. They're making it up. Why? Because they are an inherently suspicious, nefarious people. That is definitely coming into my work. I've been doing some writing. I use text in my work quite a lot in titles, but also like I embroider text a lot. And so there will be some pieces that address this unfortunate phenomenon.
Is the way you're tackling those issues in the art just through the words or some of the pieces specifically, you know, visualizing it?
That's a good question. So at first, the first pieces that I was making, and again, like I was, as I'm sure, like I was paralyzed in terms of the studio. I didn't make anything for a while. And then when I first did, I was painting violent scenes. And I started, because I paint and then I do the sewing afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I started even embroidering this one piece. And I was like, this isn't you, Zoe. This isn't, like, I'm glad that I did this. Mm-hmm. I got it out.
Right.
And let me put that away in a drawer. And that's not what your next body of work is going to be. I don't want to live in that world in my studio every day. That's not what I want to put out into the world. And so I'm much more interested visually in speaking to, though, yes, our trauma, but also like our resilience, our resistance, our joy. And I do that through color and through textures, but also, you know, I'm doing these portraits of my Jewish family and community. And so I get to like choose moments of what I feel like are like empowering moments or soft, tender moments.
Nice.
But the text is where I'm really addressing this, the rape denialism, which right. I think I can't not bring that into the work.
You posted on Instagram August 11th of this year that you have been put on lists, had a solo show canceled, had people tell you they shouldn't work with you. You've been stalked and harassed online and generally dealt with a lot of ostracism from people you've been working with for over a decade. That sucks. How are you dealing with this new reality?
I don't really go to art events anymore.
Do you find the whole community is basically an unsafe place to be?
It's not that the whole community is unsafe and the whole community is hostile, because it's definitely not. It's just that I don't know in any given room in the art world, I don't know which one of these people. Like I know because people have told me categorically, Zoe, a lot of people trying to ruin you right now. A lot of people chatting shit about you and are like, you know, passing your name around to try and essentially get you canceled.
Right.
I know also overtly, because a friend told me, was like, hey, like this person I follow suddenly started making a bunch of posts like directly and in no uncertain terms about you. And she changed her bio to, I'm Zoe Buckman's number one hater. I know. What? And but
get like, a hobby.
I know. And like a bunch of people that I know continue to follow her.
That's
and
crazy.
Someone I know was like engaging in
this person
in her
you know
stuff.
Personally?
No, I don't know who this woman
don't
is.
Even know
I've
this woman.
I've never met her, but
great.
Yeah, awesome. But this is the thing where it's like I don't know in any space in the art world. I don't know who hates me and
right.
is trying to ruin my career. So therefore, I just kind of rather stay home, which also sucks because I'm like, am I letting them win? You know?
Yeah.
And it's like some weeks I feel way more like I can and I do. And I'll go someplace and I'll be like, actually, that was really nice and lovely. And, you know, I get a lot of people now in the art world coming up to me and in hushed tones being like, thanks so much for your advocacy.
Yeah, I imagine that's the case. I feel like a lot of people experience that. And that sort of leads to another question I wanted to ask you, which is, have new opportunities arisen for you because of you being outspoken and being so proudly Jewish that wouldn't have before?
I'm glad you asked that, because I don't want people to think that, you know, speaking out against anti-Semitism is a career ruiner. And not only do I not want them to think that because I want them to join me, I do want them to join me. I am tired of being like one of the only voices in as an artist in the art world who is consistently speaking up about these things. I'm fucking tired of it, Jonah.
Yeah.
So I do want people to feel empowered to do it. But also the truth is that like I've kind of career-wise and sales-wise, I've had like a really great year.
Amazing.
In a time where, you know, the market is really bad right now. A lot of people are not buying art. It always happens when there's uncertainty and an election and wars and whatnot. But I think that a lot of people and Jewish collectors are in a place where like they want to engage with their stories. They want to engage with their histories that they probably haven't either in the past or for a while. They've been collecting art that speaks about other things and they're feeling vulnerable, understandably, and they want to own something that feels familiar to them and that makes them feel like it's speaking to them or about them or whatnot. So actually, this whole horrible, ugly moment, though it's definitely closed a lot of doors for me. It's also opened a bunch as well. So like, thank God.
I think that's, you know, important for people to hear.
Yeah.
I think there's really this, and I've talked about it before on the show, there's a very vague fear about being proudly Jewish. People aren't quite sure what it is they're afraid of. They're afraid of, as Van Jones said on my show, smoke.
Yeah.
It's like, what is it? And you might have somebody be mean to you online and say they're your number one hater. You might this, that, and the other. But like, here you are, you're making money, you're still doing your thing.
Yeah.
It's like, you didn't disappear into the abyss.
Yeah,
it's like, you're gonna be okay.
Yeah, yeah, it will open you up to a different audience or different
cohort.
Right,
and then you'll find people who
support.
Love you and support you, and that feels better than, you know, having closet haters buying your stuff anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think it's possible to salvage the relationship between the social justice progressive world and the Jewish community? So you've been very involved in social justice for a number of different causes. And, you know, very famously over this past year, a lot of those people have disappeared when it comes to standing with Jews. And so do you feel like there's any hope there?
If I look back at like our people and our history, I think we have to recognize that we've engaged in a shitload of forgiveness, right? Mm-hmm. Because, like, you know, if you look at the attempts to wipe us off of the map over and over again, like, obviously we are a people who, when we regroup, are like, okay, let's go forward,
right,
shall we?
Right.
So I think anything is possible, and I hope that there can be bridges and that there can be, like, restorative experiences. Right now, the thing that I feel that it would take would be, like, a really huge paradigm shift and a movement for those who have engaged in so much anti-Semitic rhetoric. They would have to, like, make us feel safe again, mm-hmm, and seen again in order for there to be, like, a true repairing.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I think that's going to happen,
yeah,
at least not anytime soon, unfortunately.
Yeah.
What do you think?
The one constant is change, right? If something's right up here, sooner or later, it's going to be down there and vice versa. And, you know, this isn't, mm-hmm, 1930s Germany. There are people speaking out.
Yeah.
And I feel like there will be a return to sanity. It depends a little bit on how the next couple years go, but I remain optimistic.
Good, I like that.
Yeah. Speaking of optimism, yeah, what's up next for you in the art world?
Yeah, so I have some work in a few different group shows right now. One is SF MoMA.
Cool.
Which is very cool. And that will then travel to the Perez Art Museum in Miami and Crystal Bridges, which is in Arkansas. I have some work in the Norton Museum, which is in Florida. And then I heard that the National Portrait Gallery, who also acquired a piece of mine a year or so ago, they're going to be hanging that piece finally, which that'll be fucking cool for me on a personal level, because I'll get to go home to London to a museum that obviously I went to a bunch when I was a kid.
That's amazing.
And I'll get to see something that I made.
That's so cool.
But my next solo show, Please Come, it's not for a while, so I've got some time to really let the work percolate, but it's, mm-hmm, going to be very much about, you know, our community and our community's relationship to the concept of the home. And that will take place next Miami Art Basel at a gallery called Mindy Solomon. So that will be during Miami Art Basel 2025. We'll get on our hovercrafts and we'll go.
Sounds good to me. So I better hurry. When is Art Basel? What part of the year?
It's in December.
December 25.
Yeah. So that'll be November through January. Yeah, exactly. I've got some time.
Amazing.
Yeah.
All right, let's do a quick little lightning round.
All right.
Do, dump, or marry? London, LA, New York.
Wait, do is fuck?
Yeah.
Fuck, marry, kill.
It's fuck, marry,
kill. Fuck, marry, kill, but like the PG.
The PG version.
The PG, yeah, version. Wait, say it again. So I...
Do, dump, or marry? London, LA, New York.
You marry New York. You fuck London, you dump LA. Sorry, oh, babes. I'm sorry.
It's fine.
Also, like, when I say you fuck London, also fuck London.
Yeah,
sometimes fuck London,
yeah,
also.
Okay.
You angry fuck London.
There you go.
There it is.
Okay. Favorite Jewish holiday?
I'm really getting into Hanukkah right now.
Yeah.
Like, because I didn't grow up with that. And, mm-hmm, I'm like, this is awesome. And it's an extended one, and we get to eat all those donuts.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it.
It's a lot of good stuff.
Yeah.
Favorite Jewish food?
Labneh.
Labneh.
Yeah.
Delicious.
Yeah. I want to that's where I want to go after I've died. I want to go inside.
Into the labneh.
Yeah. What's your favorite Jewish food?
I don't love Jewish food, to be honest.
Same girl, but you asked me.
You know, I'm going to say chicken noodle soup,
oh, yeah,
with challah to dip in the soup.
Oh, yeah. That's
and
a
like
good
matzo
one.
Ball soup.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those are
very
my favorites.
Good ones.
Yeah. Okay, last, we're going to do our social media questions,
oh, okay,
that people have for you from our Instagram audience, which,
oh,
remember, you can do every week. We announce our guests before they come on. You can go on and post your questions, and we're gonna read them to them. So Gold for Bean asks, my sister-in-law called me an October 8th Jew based on me starting to wear a Star of David on October 8th. Am I not a real Jew?
You are so a real Jew, and thank you.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We need everybody.
Yeah, let's have way more unity.
Limor Gott. Hi, Limor. What can we do to help Jewish and Israeli artists who are being boycotted right now?
We can buy their art. Like, we can buy their art. We can, if we have connections to exhibit, share their art online. Like, these, it's really, really important that we do this.
Tina J. Gatan asks, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I am quite a sort of like no regrets person in that I feel like all our mistakes and the difficult things that we experience in our lives are there to teach us something, right? Mm-hmm. So therefore, it's hard for me to think of advice to give to my younger self who's about to make a whole bunch of fuck ups. I think, though, it would be about one's instincts. I think it would be to just trust your instincts, because you know that voice inside of you, like, just always connect back to that, because she knows.
That's so important. And so, so easy to let the noise and other people's opinions and ideas filter in there. Mm-hmm. And you got to trust your gut.
Yeah.
Love it. Thank you so much to my guest Zoe Buckman for making the trek from Brooklyn to be here with me today. Thanks to Johan here at Hof Studios for making everything go smoothly. And thank you for being part of the Being Jewish family. We are growing every week, so thank you. And please continue to share the show with your communities in whatever way you can. See y'all back here for the next super duper episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt.
Thank you to everyone who makes Being Jewish with Jonah Platt possible. Executive producer Matthew Jones, story producer Sean Libyashvili, and editor Patrick Edwards of Rainbow Creative. Consulting producers Bethany Mandel and Ariella Novak of Shield Communications, social media manager Yuval Yosha, graphic designer Noah Bell of Bellboy Creative, my incredible research assistant Samantha Greenwald, everyone at Aura House Studios, the whole team at Jewish Broadcasting Service, composer Gabe Mann, and of course you, dear listeners, who even stuck around to listen to all these credits. Man, I love you guys.